Chapter 2 Araby. North Richmond Street was a quiet street, except at the hour when the Christian Brothers School set the boys free. An empty two-story house stood at one end, detached from its neighbours. The other houses in the street, conscious of decent lives within them, gazed at one another with brown, untroubled faces. A priest who had lived in our house had died in the back room. Air, dusty from the rooms being closed, hung in all the rooms, and the little room behind the kitchen was full of old, useless papers. Among these, I found a few books covered in paper, the pages of which were curled and damp. The Abbot by Walter Scott, The Devout Communicant, and The Memoirs of Vidocq. I liked the last best because its pages were yellow. The wild garden behind the house contained a central apple tree and a few bushes, under which I found the old priest's rusty bicycle. He had been a very fine priest. In his will, he had left all his money to institutions and the furniture of his house to his sister. When the dark days of winter came, dusk fell before we had finished eating our dinners. When we met in the street, the houses had grown sombre. The sky above us was the colour of ever-changing violet, and the street lamps lifted their light up to it. The cold air was bitter, and we played until our bodies glowed. Our shouts echoed in the silent street. Our energetic play took us through the dark, dirty, damp streets behind the houses, where we met the rough children from the cottages, to the back doors of the dark, smelly gardens, to the dark, smelly place where a man looked after his horses. When we returned to the street, light from the kitchen windows had filled the areas. If my uncle was turning the corner, we hid in the shadow until we were sure he was safely at home. Or if Mangan's sister came out to call her brother for tea, we watched her look up and down the street. We waited to see whether she would stay outside or go in, and if she remained, we left our shadow and walked up to Mangan's sadly. She was waiting for us, her figure defined by the light from the half-open door. Her brother always teased her before he obeyed, and I stood by the railings looking at her. Her dress swung with her body, and the soft rope of her hair moved from side to side. Every morning I lay on the floor in the front room, watching her door. I kept the blind down so that there was a tiny gap so that I could not be seen. When she came outside, my heart jumped. I ran to the hall, gathered up my books, and followed her. Her brown figure was always in my sight, and when we came near the point where we went in different directions, I walked a little faster and passed her. This happened morning after morning. I had never spoken to her except for a few casual words, and yet her name was everything. Her image was always with me, even in places which were hostile to romance. On Saturday evenings, when my aunt went to the market, I had to go to carry some of her parcels. We walked through the busy streets, pushing past noisy men and bargaining women, past crowds of workmen, listening to the shouting shop boys selling street food and the chanting of street singers who sang revolutionary songs or read poems about the troubles in our native land. These noises became a single sensation of life for me. I imagined that I was carrying a chalice safely through a crowd of enemies. Her name came to my lips at moments in strange prayers and words which I myself did not understand. My eyes were often full of tears, I did not know why, and at times a flood seemed to pour out from my heart. I thought little of the future. I did not know whether I would ever speak to her or not, or, if I spoke to her, how I could tell her about my confused adoration. But my body was like a harp, and her words and movements were like fingers on its strings. One evening I went into the back room where the priest had died. It was a dark, rainy evening, and there was no sound in the house. Through the broken window I could hear the rain on the earth. I could see the light from a window in the distance. I was glad that I could see so little. All my senses were confused, and, feeling like I was going to swoon, I held the palms of my hands together until they trembled, repeating to myself, oh love, many times. At last, she spoke to me. When she addressed the first words to me, in my confusion, I did not know what to answer. She asked me if I was going to Araby. I forgot whether I answered yes or no. It would be a splendid bazaar. She said she would love to go. And why can't you? I asked. While she spoke, she turned a silver bracelet round and round her wrist. She could not go, she said, because she would be away. Her brother and two other boys were fighting in the street, and I was alone at the railings. She held one of the spikes of the railings, bowing her head towards me. The light from the lamp opposite our door caught the white curve of her neck, lit up her hair, and, falling, lit up the hand on the railing. It caught the side of her dress and the white of her petticoat, just visible as she stood there, relaxed.
"You're lucky," she said.
"If I go," I said, "I will bring you something." I couldn't sleep that night. I thought of nothing else all day. What thoughts I had! I wished I could murder the tedious days until Araby. Work at school was boring. At night in my bedroom and by day in the classroom, her image came between me and the page I was trying to read. I heard the eastern syllables of the word Araby through the silence in my soul and was enchanted. I asked for permission to go to the bazaar on Saturday night. My aunt was surprised. I answered few questions in class. I watched my schoolmaster's face pass from kindness to sternness. He hoped I was not turning into a lazy boy. I could not call my wandering thoughts together. I had hardly any patience with the serious work of life, which, now that it stood between me and my desire, seemed to me child's play, ugly, monotonous child's play. On Saturday morning, I reminded my uncle that I wished to go to the bazaar in the evening. He was in the hall, looking for his hat, and answered me shortly, "Yes, boy, I know." As he was in the hall, I could not go into the front room and lie on the floor in front of the window. I felt the whole house was in a bad mood and walked slowly towards school. The air was pitilessly cold, and already my heart was filled with doubts. When I came home to dinner, my uncle had not yet been home. Still, it was early. I sat staring at the clock for some time, and when its ticking began to irritate me, I left the room. I went up the stairs to the top floor. The high, cold, empty, gloomy rooms liberated me, and I went from room to room singing. From the front window I saw my companions playing below in the street. I could hear their shouts, and, leaning my head against the cool glass, I looked over at the dark house where she lived. I may have stood there for an hour. In my imagination, I saw her dressed in brown, her neck touched gently by the light from the lamp, her hand on the railings. When I came downstairs again, I found Mrs. Mercer sitting in front of the fire. She was an old, gossipy woman. I had to endure the tea-table conversation. The meal had been finished for over an hour, and still my uncle did not come. Mrs. Mercer stood up to go. She was sorry she couldn't wait any longer, but it was after 8 o'clock, and she did not like to be out late, as the night air was bad for her. When she had gone, I began to pace up and down the room. My aunt said, "I'm afraid there will be no trip to the bazaar tonight." At 9 o'clock, I heard my uncle's key in the hall door. I heard him talking to himself and heard the noise as he took off his coat. When he was halfway through his dinner, I asked him to give me the money to go to the bazaar. He had forgotten. "Everyone's asleep in bed by now," he said. I did not smile. My aunt said to him energetically, "Can't you give him the money and let him go? You've made him late enough as it is." My uncle said he was very sorry he had forgotten. He asked me where I was going, and when I told him a second time, he asked me whether I knew the Arab's farewell to his steed. When I left the kitchen, he was about to recite the opening lines of the poem to my aunt. I held the coin tight in my hand as I strode down Buckingham Street towards the station. The sight of the street crowded with shoppers and glaring with light from the gas lamps reminded me of the reason for my journey. I took my place in a third-class seat of an empty train. After an intolerable delay, the train moved out of the station slowly. It crept on past numerous old houses and over the river. At Westland Row station, a crowd of people moved towards the carriage doors, but the porters moved them back, saying that it was a special train for the bazaar. I remained alone in the empty train. In a few minutes, the train stopped beside a temporary platform. I walked out onto the road and saw that the clock stood at 10 minutes to 10. In front of me was a large building, which displayed the magical name Araby. I could not find any cheap entrance, and, afraid that the bazaar would be closed, I paid the full price to a tired-looking man. I found myself in a big, impressive hall. Nearly all the stalls were closed, and the greater part of the hall was in darkness. I recognized the silence. It was like a church after a service. I walked into the center of the hall timidly. A few people were gathered around the stalls which were still open. In front of a curtain, over which the words "Café Chantant" were written, two men were counting money on a silver plate. I listened to the fall of the coins. Remembering with difficulty why I had come, I went over to one of the stalls and examined porcelain vases and flowered tea sets. At the door of the stall, a young lady was talking and laughing with two gentlemen. I noticed their English accents and listened to their conversation.
"Oh, I never said such a thing."
"Oh, but you did."
"Oh, but I didn't."
"Didn't she say that?" "Yes, I heard her."
"Oh, that's a lie."
Observing me, the young lady came over and asked me if I wanted to buy anything. Her voice was not encouraging. She seemed to have spoken to me out of a sense of duty. I looked humbly at the great vases that stood like Eastern guards at either side of the dark entrance to the stall and murmured,
"No, thank you."
The young lady changed the position of one of the vases and went back to the two young men. They began to talk about the same subject. Once or twice, the young lady glanced at me over her shoulder. I stayed for a while near her stall, although I knew my stay was useless. Then I turned away slowly and walked down the middle of the bazaar. I allowed 2 pennies to fall against the shilling in my pocket. The upper part of the hall was now completely dark. Gazing up into the darkness, I saw myself as a creature driven and derided by vanity. and my eyes burnt with anguish and anger.